The Earl of Warren, young man. That's why I've arrived so late. He lives way up in the bloody Bloomingdale.
I see. In that case, sir, I'm certain we can make an exception.
The man smiled and handed Cormac the sheet of paper.
Wonderful. You can deliver them, of course.
They briefly discussed price and paper size and type fonts, then the directions to the Earl's mansion, and off the man went. Mr. Partridge was hesitant about breaking the rule against advertising for slaves.
I suppose you think the posters will gain you access to his house?
Aye.
And then you'll lop off his head.
The way he said this made Cormac laugh. Partridge gazed at the copy and then walked to the type tray.
He should be killed just for what he does to the English language. But if you must do this dreadful thing, you must be smart. If you go directly to the house and send the wretch to perdition, they'll have you with the hangman 3 days later, and I'll lose the best apprentice I ever had, and the primary investor in this shop, so please, use your head for something other than parking your hat.
Cormac thought, he's right. That night, after most of the type was set, Cormac wandered the town for an hour, the weather chilly but no longer wet or arctic cold. He felt he could not join the rebellion without first killing the Earl. Either way, if the rebellion then succeeded, or if it failed in a chaos of gunpowder and death, he could escape with Mary Burton. He could lead her across the river. As he tried to imagine the future, he strolled through dark streets past the fort where three prostitutes laughed together in the shadows. He turned through unlit streets toward Cortlandt Street, planning to enter the shop through the alley. A hand gripped his biceps in the blackness, like a vice.
Cormac, come with me.
Congo released his grip and began to walk. They headed toward the North River.
You need to kill that man, before the big trouble.
I hope. And now I have a way in, to his big house.
He explained about the proofs of the posters.
Good, Congo said. My friends, they have watched the house. And we have a man in the stable. He is with us.
Cormac felt his blood streaming through his arms and legs.
Here is what we do, Congo said.
Quacko waited on the driveway in a borrowed phaeton while Cormac stood at the door of the mansion. The late afternoon light was rosy, the wind soft. Three armed men watched him as the lean man with the coarse skin, now dressed in the more formal clothes of a butler, handed him an envelope. Payment for the posters.
The master says very good work indeed, he muttered, and there's a bit extra for delivery.
Cormac thanked him and turned away, glancing at the stable where three of the Earl's Africans were watching and smoking. He climbed back in the phaeton, and Quacko flicked a whip. They trotted back down the road to the south. When they were out of sight, Cormac thanked Quacko, asked him to hold the envelope until he saw him next, and dropped into the forest. He moved toward the river along the Indian trail marked by Congo on a rough map. He waited in the shrubbery until the sun slipped down behind New Jersey and the sky turned mauve. On the near side of a huge rock, out of sight of the Earl's house, was Congo's boat. He was poised at the oars. After Cormac climbed in, the African began rowing back upriver until they saw the glow of the Earl's house against the darkening sky. Cormac could make out the Earl's dock and the stairs leading up the cliff, and then the house itself.
Until later, Cormac said.
Cormac removed his long coat and the sling for the sword and dropped both on the bottom of the boat. Then he jammed the sword into his belt and waded ashore. He knew the house from another sketch made by Congo's man in the stable. Approaching the southern side of the house, Cormac saw the huge oak tree. He began to climb the trunk. Lantern light burned beyond the doors of the second floor balcony. That was the goal, the Earl's study. He crawled out upon the thick oak limb leading to the balcony. He stood, legs bent, about to leap, when he heard footsteps below on the gravel. A man walked around the corner, a face familiar from the Earl's company in town. He carried a musket and whistled in the dark.
If he looks up, Cormac thought, I'm dead.
The man below continued walking around to the deck in back.
I must go now. And he did. He leaped, grasped the balcony railing, held hard, he stepped over the rail.
He looked in at the room, The Earl was at a desk with curved legs made of polished wood. There was a pistol on the desk beside his inkpot, and he could see the three porcelain balls, red, white, and blue, that the Earl had used to entertain his men outside a building in Belfast. Cormac turned the door handle gently and stepped inside with his sword drawn. He moved quickly to the desk. The Earl looked up with alarmed eyes and reached for the pistol. Cormac placed the blade of the sword across his wrist, took the pistol and shoved it in his own belt.
"What is this?" the Earl said. "There's no gold here, no specie, nothing for you to peddle in town. I have a dozen men guarding this house.
I don't want gold. I want an explanation. I want to know why you killed my father."
Now the Earl studied Cormac's bearded face in the muted light, searching time, searching memory.
"I'll tell you what killed my own father," he said. "Whiskey. Or whiskey and rum and too much wine."
He reached for the three balls and stood up and slowly began juggling them. "I was raised by an uncle who had been orphaned himself, and went off with a troop of buskers instead of going to school. He taught me how to do this." The balls moved more swiftly now, and Cormac thought, "I've come to kill you, you idiot, and you're making an entertainment."
"You haven't answered my question," Cormac said. "A bit more than a year ago, on a road in Ireland, you and your men stopped an Irishman and told him to surrender his horse. He refused, and you killed him."
Now the Earl understood. The balls slowed in the air, and one at a time he snatched them into his right hand. He gazed at Cormac.
"You're talking about that fool, Patch."
"No, you made it happen, sir. I was there."
"The man refused to obey a law.
A law that didn't apply to him. My father wasn't Catholic."
"He was Irish, wasn't he?"
the Earl said.
"But not Catholic."
A feathery sound on the balcony, and now Congo was there, eyes alert, carrying a canvas shroud. The Earl's eyes widened.
"Do you recognize this African, sir? Your company kidnapped him and brought him here in manacles."
The Earl began speaking more quickly, the words bunching.
"You're talking out of a profound stupidity. You'll surely hang unless I plead for your wretched life."
"Thank you," Cormac thought. "I was beginning to pity you, and now you've shown me your true face."
The Earl saw Congo spreading the shroud upon the carpeted floor, as if preparing a ceremony. The Earl lunged for the pistol. He gripped the barrel, then forced open the lock, prepared to shoot. Cormac slammed the flat of the sword across his brow. Cormac pried the gun loose of the Earl's grip and tossed it to Congo.
"That was stupid," Cormac said.
"I'm sorry,"
the Earl said in a beaten voice. A thin line of blood lay open on his brow.
"Here, I'll give you some money."
He played with a key in a locked desk drawer.
"Not enough for the terrible thing that happened to your father, but nothing changes with you ever," Cormac said. "You tried to pay for my mother's death, too. Do you remember that? She died under the wheels of your coach, in the mud."
The Earl looked doomed. He opened the drawer as if fumbling for money, and then there was another pistol in his hand. Cormac rammed the sword into his heart. The Earl's surprised eyes opened wider, and so did his mouth. Cormac jerked the sword free, and the Earl's face hit hard upon the desk.
"Jesus God," Cormac thought. "I've done it. I've done what I came to America to do. I've completed the terms of the vow. Jesus God, I'm free."
Then Congo touched his arm.
"Quick," he said, "we go."
Together they laid the Earl's body in the shroud, tied the lumpy bundle with ropes, and lifted it together. He and Congo moved its dead weight to the outside stairs that would take them to the deck and the river. From the distance, he heard muffled shouts. As in Congo's plan, a fire had begun in the barn, to distract the Earl's men, to cover their flight. Cormac turned for a final look at the Earl's study, at the desk, the posters, the juggler's polished balls, and saw the room's second door open. A woman stood there, horror on her face. She was big with child. Bridget Riley. Bridget took in the bloody sword, the pistol, the lumpy shroud, and understood what had happened.
"Don't scream, Bridget," Cormac said. "You know me. We rode together through Ireland. And here you are,
still the Earl's whore, living in another big house, and now carrying the Earl's bastard. The noise from outside smothered her sudden, racked, and hopeless weeping.
Don't kill me!
For a fraction of a moment, Mary Burton and Bridget merged, their faces, bodies, masks, wombs, as if they were sisters. His contempt for Bridget, for the Earl's whore, smashed against his pity for her. Then he thought, if she's carrying the Earl's child, I must kill it, and her too. But suppose it was a girl child, suppose... Congo could no longer wait. He untied one of the cords in the shroud, went to Bridget Riley, grabbed her blouse, pulled it up over her head, exposing a laced garment covering her swelling breasts. He tied the blouse like a hood, the rope tight around her eyes. Then he stepped to the side and punched her hard. She fell without a word. Quick, he said. In the Black River, the skiff was pulled by the current. The Earl's body lay on the bottom of the boat, tied into its shroud, which was now heavy with rocks. Upriver, coming fast, they could see the bob and flicker of lights, a boat, with at least two lanterns, coming after them. The Earl's men. There was no time to feel what he'd done, taking one life, sparing two, sparing Bridget, sparing a child, almost surely the Earl's child, time only to row. Until Congo told him to stop. Then he grabbed the upper part of the wrapped shroud, and Cormac the bottom. The boat wobbled as they heaved, and the shroud sank into the black waters. Congo glanced around and then gripped the axe. We swim, he said. Congo smashed at the keel with the axe. Water erupted from one hole like a geyser. The boat slowed, the black water rose, and they were in the river. The winter river shocked Cormac. Down he plunged, ripped by the current, thinking, I am dead. I now join the Earl. Thinking, I have done what I came to do, but now I die, far from home. Thinking, revenge drowns. Then he felt a bumping beneath him. Cold and sleek and bumping him, pushing him up and up, forcing him away from the dark, drowned river bottom. It was as if he were pushed by some enormous fish, like a series of cold caresses. He surrendered to the creature. And then the world swirled, and the watery sky was full of black clouds, and the cold gauzy moon, and the bumping caresses turned him, shoved him, moved him into endless blackness. He awoke to a cold pink dawn, lying in sand and scrubby weeds. He could see the island of Manhattan and knew he was on the wild, empty shore of New Jersey. When he looked at the seabirds, he saw among them one that was black and knew that it was a raven. When Cormac arrived that afternoon after the ferry ride to the Manhattan dock, still barefoot in his soggy coat, Mr. Partridge looked relieved. Later, when he awoke that night, Mr. Partridge was setting type by lantern light. He mentioned casually that an African had delivered the money for the posters. And by the way, he said, Happy St. Patrick's Day. The night of the rising. Mr. Partridge was silent for a while, type clicking in his swift hands. Finally, the older man spoke. You've killed him, haven't you?
Aye.
And now what will you do?
I'll finish learning my trade.
And up Mr. Partridge went on the ladder. No judgments, no expressions of a regret he did not feel. Cormac sat type that night until he could no longer see. When Cormac lay down to sleep at last, he was filled again with the events that had brought him there. He hoped he would not be traced and arrested for murder most foul. He hoped Mr. Partridge was not drawn into any of it, and he feared Bridget Riley. She was the only witness. But he did not think she would give names or descriptions. She would now own everything that the Earl had owned when mysterious robbers broke in and committed murder. Better to vanish. Go home to Ireland or England instead of standing as a witness in a trial that would make her name known from here to London and certainly provoke scrutiny. And then another face appeared in his jangled reverie, another woman who might be carrying a child. Where was Mary Burton? What was she doing with her rage? What could be brewing through this long night that would come for him in the day?
and then at last he slept. In the morning, the wind was making flags curl and pushing dust and paper down Cortlandt Street. A gathering wind, a wind certain to stiffen. And when he moved through the streets to deliver posters to Jameson the vintner, he felt a strangeness in the air. He searched for Congo but didn't see him, didn't see Kwako either, or any of the other Africans he knew, and didn't even know if Congo still lived. Around 3 o'clock, he hurried down to the waterfront to look for Congo. He lolled behind the empty slave market, trying to look casual, and watched the two ships that would depart at 4, the Carolina and the Arcadia. Then a black unmarked coach, with trunks lashed to its roof, galloped in front of the Carolina. An African in livery, his face familiar from the Earl's stable, leaped down. He opened the door and offered a hand to Bridget Riley. She gazed around, near and far, her face still marked by fear, and then saw Cormac. She stopped. The African followed her gaze. Then the African whispered to Bridget Riley, and she threw Cormac a chilling glance and turned to board the ship. The gangplank was raised an instant after she stepped on deck. The African turned and walked toward Cormac, taking his hat from his graying head. "She asked me to tell you some words," the man said. "She asked me to tell you, thank you very much. She tell the constables, someone hit her, and she saw nothing that happened to her husband." The African paused, then said, "Tell Congo we are with him." He moved to the carriage, climbed to his seat, and the horses started off, heading north. Mr. Partridge and Cormac worked across the day into the night. Around 7, Mr. Partridge was joking about the contents of a marital document asking for a legal separation and musing on the folly of man. Then from the street they heard a shout followed by an excited response. They went out together, locking the shop door behind them, and turned the corner. There was a red glow in the sky above Fort George. The rising had begun. Citizens were running toward the fort. The two of them neared the fort, and there was a surge of people. Mr. Partridge went one way, Cormac another. Great orange tongues of flame roared and twisted angrily against the inky sky. Firemen arrived with their two new engines, but the water came in useless dribbles. Cormac's mind flashed on sparks from a lost forge scattering across the Irish sky, aspiring to be stars. He cut into an alley behind the Lutheran church, trying to see the fort from the riverside. Then two people rushed into the alley. Cormac flattened himself against the wall and saw Kwako running, holding the hand of his wife. Behind them were two redcoats. Cormac saw a redcoat drop to a knee and take aim, and Cormac stepped away from the wall, placing himself between the aimed musket and the fleeing African couple. An enraged British voice.
"What are... Who is... Stop, now!"
Then Cormac jerked at the barrels, and they came tumbling down with a great bumping clatter, filling the width of the alley, and Cormac ran too. Around 5 in the morning, there was good news for the English, if bad for the rebels. The wind had shifted. It began blowing out toward the harbor, away from the houses of Broadway and the larger town. Cormac walked through the ash-gritty air to Hewson's. No lights were burning. An upstairs window opened a few inches. It was Sarah Hewson.
"Yes, what is it?"
"I need to talk to Mary."
"Good luck. She's flown."
He stood there for a long moment, then moved toward the waterfront. He could see a boat moving north on the river, but there were no ships of the Spanish fleet. His mind filled with dark possibilities.
"She's flown."
The city had changed forever. Until that night, the well-fed, respectable whites had convinced themselves that slaves loved being slaves. The Africans and the Irish both knew they were nothing and therefore were happy to have food to eat and a roof above their humble, worthless heads. Now the English knew better. The fire was out at last, the king's fort a settling, smoking pile of glistening charcoal. In the shop on Cortlandt Street, Mr. Partridge had other news. Two Africans were under arrest for stealing silverware, Caesar and Prince. They'd buried it under floorboards in Hewson's Tavern on Stone Street.
and that discovery of the stolen goods led to a fresh theory, one with its own banal logic. The fire at the fort was set to cover the crime, and it seemed certain that one of the thieves, Caesar, had fathered a child with a white woman. "It's a fever out there, lad," Mr. Partridge exclaimed. More seriously, he whispered, a much wider conspiracy was being exposed. "They have an informer, some Irish wench. They've promised her money and freedom, and she can't stop talking." Cormac's stomach flopped. Mary Burton, turned informer, talking her way to freedom. That afternoon, the reaction began. A grand jury was convened. The Hewsons were arrested and swiftly condemned, with Mary Burton the chief witness against them. Within hours, Caesar and Prince were hanged on the ridge overlooking the collect pond, their bodies dumped in unmarked graves in the African cemetery on Duane Street. English flags blossomed on many buildings, some of them sewn together overnight. Another fire broke out. Then Hewson was hanged, sobbing, protesting, claiming his innocence, demanding a fair hearing. As soon as his neck was snapped by the rope, young Sandy was placed above the drop. His last word before death was, "Freedom!" The authorities left the two corpses dangling for days as a warning to Africans and Irishmen. Cormac came around 2 days later. Hewson's body had turned black, while the African's body had turned white. Some of the more fanatical citizens saw this as a dark omen. Mary Burton was hidden away somewhere, protected by agents of the grand jury, but she must not have given them Cormac's name. Nobody came knocking on the print shop door at midnight. Cormac could not find Congo, but he was sure he was alive because even the reaction didn't stop the fires. Cormac sensed Congo's plan: to create fear and uncertainty while the rebels waited for the arrival of the Spanish frigates. From the first day after the fire at the fort, the constables and redcoats started rounding up the Africans and the Irish and packing them into the new Bridewell prison. But they didn't come for him. Mary Burton, the great accuser, was also his guardian. Did she understand that now she would never be free? Dark Avengers would track her down? If she had a child, its name would be stained by her betrayal. Mr. Partridge was alarmed, for he had been moving among the fearful men who ran the town and were prepared to unleash the mobs. "You're in mortal danger, lad," he whispered. "They want every African except the ones they own. They want every Irishman." Cormac offered to leave, to keep Mr. Partridge out of danger. "It might come to that, and soon," he said, "but we've got work to do first." Together they began packing the best books and most important documents. He opened the storage space beneath the printing press and shoved the bag into the darkness. As they packed, mobs were sweeping the town. For 3 nights, Cormac searched for Congo and saw white mobs beating blacks with clubs or kicking them into meat. That Saturday night, the mobs were larger. Cormac suggested to Mr. Partridge that they rent a horse and move books and documents somewhere north, out of the city, to hide them. "I'm afraid you're right," he said. "I'll go for a horse." Off he went, and then Cormac heard a mob coming down Cortlandt Street and looked out and saw Congo. Cormac grabbed the sword and stepped outside as the mob rushed by the shop. Congo was down, his skull bloodied. The whites kicked at him, screaming, "Fucking cannibal! Goddamned savage! Black bastard!" Cormac broke through, holding the sword. "Enough," he said. "Let him be. If you kill him, you'll all be charged with murder. I'll make certain of that." They backed up, wary of the sword. One man rushed with a pole and Cormac cut it in half. Then Michaels, the old constable, pushed through the crazed men, his lantern held high. "Not another kick, you lot. Away with ye." His severe tone was enough to stop them. The constable told 4 of them to remain, to help him bring Congo to a holding pen. Congo stood up. He said something in Yoruba, and the constable dubbed him across the brow. "He was thanking you, Mr. Michaels," Cormac said. "For what? I wish they'd killed him." Congo was bleeding from a deep gash in the back of his head. The sight of blood encouraged one of the 4 men. He stepped forward and kicked Congo in the groin. Congo doubled over, refusing to utter a sound. "You must have balls of iron, nigger. Let's try it again."
Cormac stepped forward, now holding the sword for all to see. "Release him," Cormac said.
"You'll be hanged for this," the constable said.
"Perhaps, but you'll be dead." The constable looked anxious. Then one of the whites fired a pistol. Pain cut through Cormac's left shoulder. Cormac turned, bleeding from chest and back, swung the sword down, cut into a meaty thigh, and the fat man holding the pistol fell in a gush of blood and high-pitched wailing. Another man drew a sword. Cormac wobbled, losing blood, but even a feeble swing severed the swordsman's hand from its wrist. The man rose in panic. The constable ran after him, and so did the others. Cormac sliced through Congo's ropes. And then he was on a horse, lashed to Congo, his blood seeping into Congo's body, as Congo's blood seeped into his own. He felt the sword lashed to his bleeding back. He was up on a great horse under a red moon. The horse knew the way, this sleek black horse, a horse called Thunder. He was a long way away, drifting in silent seas. He saw nothing but the emerald water, and dreamed no dreams, and longed for nothing. And then came awake on a bed of bay and thatch on the floor of a cave with a high granite roof. His eyes moved from roof to side. He saw the worn leather satchel of Mr. Partridge a dozen feet away. He saw his sword lying upon a thatch mat. Then he heard footsteps, bare feet on sandy earth. And from some dark place, Congo appeared above him. He squatted and took Cormac's hand and stared into his eyes.
"You've been dead for 9 days," Congo said in Yoruba.
Cormac thought, "He speaks Yoruba to me, and I understand each word." Congo told him they were in a cave at the very top of the island of Manhattan, in a wild place, just below the smaller river that cut across the top of the island. Then a figure emerged from the darkness behind Congo, tall in her flowing white cotton gown, her face as beautiful as Cormac remembered, Tamora. Tamora closed her eyes and began to chant in Yoruba. Cormac knew that she was offering a prayer to the wind god and the moon god, the river god and the forest god. She prayed to all the inhabitants of the other world. She begged them to reject Cormac, to give him life. Then she kissed Cormac on the lips, and he felt her warm breath mingling with his own. She pressed her fingertips to each of his temples, and then kissed each of his eyes until they closed into sleep. When he woke, Tamora was gone and Congo was dressed in the clothes of the American world.
"I must go soon," the African said.
Cormac sat up without pain, the skin of his chest marked only by a thin white line.
"How long have I been here?" he asked in Yoruba.
"In your time, almost 3 weeks, including the 9 days when you were dead."
"I understand your language."
"Of course," Congo said, smiling. "My blood is mixed with yours, and yours with mine."
"That wasn't a dream. Tamora was here."
"She gave you a gift."
And then, in careful language, turning his head to gaze at the walls of the cave, he explained. The gift was life, long life, perhaps eternal life. Then he laid out the limits.
"Your life will be lived here, on this granite island, this Manhattan. If you leave, if you cross the waters, you will die, and be forever barred from entering the other world. Choosing to leave would be choosing to kill yourself. You can be shot or stabbed, your bones can be broken. Life will not free you from pain, but you will not die."
He closed his eyes and his brow tightened, as if he were receiving a message.
"There are only 2 ways to find release. I told you the first. If you leave this island, then you will die. But someday, if you choose, there can be an end after all your living. You will meet a dark-skinned woman. Her body will be adorned with spirals. You will love her. She will love you. You will lie down with her here, in this place. You will enter her in this deep part of the granite island. And then, only then, if you wish, will you be able to pass to the other world."
Cormac began to dress, remembering their flight from death, the sensation of riding Thunder through the night.
The great horse is gone, Congo said as if reading the younger man's mind. I sent him back. Now you must go on foot, as must I.
We can go together, Congo.
No, I must go home now. There's a ship that will take me to Africa, leaving from Boston, and I must go there, a privateer.
Cormac asked, What is happening in the city?
Congo breathed deeply. The rebellion is crushed. The Spaniards didn't come to the harbor. The English burned or hanged 18 Africans and 4 Irish. They enjoy killing when they think their god has given a blessing. But it was not a failure, just a defeat.
Was Mary Burton the informer?
Yes. She caused much death.
With that, he embraced Cormac and kissed his brow.
Remember, to live, you must live. I will see you again. That I promise.
He turned and walked quickly into the darkness to follow the forest trails to the sea trails that would take him home.
Part 5. Revolutions. They waited in the dark with the ridge of the forest at their backs and Kip's Bay before them. Cormac moved among them, his own face as black as theirs, skin stained with ink. He nodded at Bantu, who was stocky and muscled and cradling a smoothbore musket.
Maybe they don't come, Bantu said.
They'll come, Cormac said.
They squatted together for a while, staring at the dull waters of the East River. All around them in the cool September night there were other soldiers, thousands of them, all waiting. But here they only cared for one another, the Black Patrol. 6 of them, including Cormac, who had recruited them in the months before the beginning of the war. Alert to sounds in the forest and echoes from the river, Cormac closed his eyes and leaned back against a tree. They had been waiting now for 2 days for the force that Washington was certain would come to this cove along the river. He remembered the first time he saw Washington, hearing his laconic words about the coming struggle, the need for all of them to take arms and, if necessary, sacrifice their lives in order to be free. He wondered if Mary Burton was still alive. He had never heard from her again. She would now be 51, but she was gone, as Congo was gone, as Kwako and his woman were gone. And I am here, he thought, obeying the command to live by taking lives, killing strangers. He looked like the same 17-year-old who had learned the printing trade in a shop on Cortlandt Street. The same young man who had buried Mr. Partridge after the cholera took him in 1753, while he raved about the coming Republic of America. The same young man who had sold the print shop to a competitor and gone to work at the John Street Theater to be instructed in the use of masks and dyes and the postures of disguise. In the mirror, he was that same young man. The one who last saw Congo in a cave in Inwood and learned across the years that the words he spoke to Cormac there were true. He was alive and young, while everyone else his age was old or dead.
They come, Bantu said.
They arrived at dawn in 84 6-oared longboats, each carrying 12 men. The English wore red and the Hessians wore blue. The guns of the frigates roared. All around the Black Patrol, the earth exploded with fire and metal. They waited, saving ball and shot. They could hear scrambling in the woods behind them, men panting. They saw 4 Hessians lumbering up the hill from the river's edge. They waited, then killed them all. As the sun struggled to rise in Brooklyn, they could see Kip's Bay more clearly, and the steady movement of empty longboats returning for more soldiers and packed longboats rowing toward the shore. They eased around in the darkness in a single file. The 6 men of the Black Patrol found their way to a cluster of jagged boulders at the crest of a hill. Now they could see the Americans in flight, farm boys and city lads, brave while marching, panicky in the face of cannon and bayonets.
Don't show yourselves, Cormac told the others, and don't shoot our own lads. Hold as long as you can.
2 columns of the enemy began climbing the slope, about 20 yards apart. The air exploded as they poured fire on the troops below. Men fell like broken dolls, face forward or whipped to the side. Hundreds of the retreating Americans were desperate to reach the crest of the hill and the plain beyond. And then through the smoke and noise, they saw Washington. He was high on a sorrel horse, waving a sword in his right hand, his eyes ablaze, his mouth a tight slash.
"Are you soldiers or mice?" he shouted. "What do you call yourselves?"
He swung his sword at one fleeing man and missed, and then glanced at Cormac and the blacks. He paused, and then started forward, into the guns. It was as if he wanted to be shot down to end his shame. Cormac grabbed the reins of Washington's horse.
"Stop, you stupid bastard!" Cormac screamed. "We need you alive, goddamn you!"
Cormac hauled the horse around, and Bantu ran up and slapped the horse hard on the haunch, and away he went, carrying the general through the trees. The other men of the Black Patrol stood laughing. Then they turned, backing up, and killed more men. The cannon screamed through the night, exploding around them, scattering soldiers, collapsing tents. Cormac knew what was happening. The English and their hired Hessian soldiers wanted to smash the Americans here in Harlem Heights, capture or kill Washington. If they could do that, the revolution would be over. Washington that night would not let them do any of that. He was everywhere, sword in hand, his face filled with furies, shouting, commanding, calling on pride.
"Die on your knees, you crazy American bastards! Send them all to hell, boys!"
And they held the lines. Then Cormac looked up, and there was Washington on his horse, right above them.
"Their cannon are killing us," he shouted. "Get your niggers and destroy the cannon!"
Cormac thought, "They are not niggers. They're Americans." But Washington was gone, and there was no time for debate. Cormac and the Black Patrol slipped down the western side of the ridge. Then they saw the clearing, 5 cannon on wheels, 12 redcoats loading balls, pouring powder. They became a single creature made for killing. They stabbed and slashed and ripped. They chopped at necks. Then it was over.
"We should take the heads," Bantu said. "They weigh too fuggin' much," another said.
They laughed and then went silent. And then, as time stretched and compressed, they heard another sound, a distant roar punctuated by rifle shots. It was the Americans. A soldier from the Continental Army shouted,
"We've broken their lines! They're running!"
A hard gray rain began falling. When the Black Patrol came to an abandoned farmhouse, they entered and bolted the doors behind them. Cormac told the others to sleep while he stood the first watch. In the morning, they started the journey to the north to meet with Washington's triumphant army. At last, they saw the escarpment of Harlem Heights outlined against the dawn. It was empty. Washington's army was gone.
"They've marched to White Plains," an American scout told them. "The whole lot of them."
The Black Patrol was silent, staring at one another's stunned faces. They'd been left behind, abandoned. Cormac looked south. The sun was seeping into the sky above Brooklyn.
"Let's go," he said to the others.
"Where?" asked Bantu.
"New York," he said.
They fought their own war now. They sawed through the beams of bridges at midnight, spilling carriages and caissons into streams. They broke into warehouses and killed guards and stole rifles and sent the guns on boats across the river to New Jersey. Most of all, they burned houses.
"They keep taking houses for their soldiers and their officers," Cormac said. "We have to force them to sleep in the rain."
He explained what had been done in 1741, and how the conspirators had waited a day for the wind. They must set up everything carefully, straw, paper, oil, kindling. So they did. In the afternoons, one at a time, they wandered past the places where the fire pumps were stored and punctured the bottoms of water buckets and sliced holes in the hoses. At night, Cormac dreamed of fire and destruction. The rest of life seemed almost normal. As the English officers arrived in New York, the Tories welcomed them, throwing elegant parties, hosting nights of song and loyalty at the John Street Theater. Then one night, as a hard wind blew toward the west, the fire began. Cormac set it off in the empty upstairs rooms of a tavern called the Fighting Cocks, down by the waterfront off Whitehall. The barroom was full of Hessians singing in German, and Cormac left through a window. Cormac and the patrol moved separately north.
Then, at the bottom of the common, he stood very still and saw flames rising in the immense steeple of Trinity Church, the tallest building in New York, the symbol of English domination. The steeple wobbled, then fell straight down in a giant roar. It was time to go. He hurried to the hill above the collect, where the Africans waited. The sky to the south was as bright now as noon, and they could see tongues of flame rising from many houses below Wall Street.
"Let them sleep in snow," Bantu said.
When the long night was over, 407 houses had been reduced to smoking rubble. Now it was the Tories' turn to trudge north to their estates or to board ships for land. Soldiers, hard Tories, and Americans settled in for a long occupation. Cormac and the Black Patrol found shelter in the swamp beyond the collect in an old cabin. Each day, one of them would slip into the town to find food, to pick up news and gather information about future targets. They learned that the English were making concessions to the Africans now. They called them pledges. The message was simple. If the Africans swore loyalty to the crown, if they defended their masters, they would be freed at the end of the war.
"Do you believe them?" Cormac asked Bantu one cold night in the swamp.
"No."
"Why not?"
"You take freedom. Nobody give it to you."
None of the Black Patrol wanted to return forever to Africa. They didn't want to live in a land where human beings were trapped like animals and then sold to others. Africa was a bitter memory. They wanted to live out their lives in America. For weeks, scavengers worked the mounds of ruined houses. The rich were gone, but the poor now gathered on the fringes of the ruined streets in tents made of old sailcloth, the place soon named Canvas Town. Snow fell, blanketing the town. The tents of Canvas Town sagged under the weight and sometimes collapsed. Washington was losing every battle, off in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania, but he was not defeated. As long as he remained alive, the revolution lived. The Black Patrol destroyed 17 bridges. It fired 2 more warehouses. They moved when instinct told them to move. One night, while they packed their things for a shift to a new place, the English arrived. A soldier from Leeds cut their comrade's throat where he stood watch. Then an officer bellowed at the shack.
"We know you're there, and it's best you surrender."
Bantu snuffed a candle with his fingers. They listened tensely to the officer's voice. Cormac and the other men of the patrol glanced at each other, then sighed. Then they rushed out the door, firing guns, Cormac wielding the sword. For a long moment, men screamed and cursed and shouted. Cormac slashed and swung and pivoted and slashed again. Men cried in pain. He saw Bantu's chest explode. He saw the front of another African face vanish. Then his own head exploded in high white pain. He woke up in a windowless cell in the Bridewell prison, packed tightly with other men, who told him that almost 800 of them were now jailed on 3 floors. His head was splitting with pain.
"The sword," he thought. "They have my father's sword."
He told himself, "Someday you will find the sword again." Men died on all the floors of the Bridewell, stinking of shit and sickness. Smallpox took many of them, and cholera too. The rations were meager, bits of gristly pork, pieces of biscuit. There were no blacks in this jail. They were being kept in a place called the Old Sugar Factory. Cormac saw men laid here upon the floor at night, crushed against one another, trying to keep warm, and in the morning they counted the corpses. Cormac thought himself lucky. At least they had not moved him beyond Manhattan to the prison ships in Wallabout Bay, for he would surely have died.
"I must stay here," he thought, "stay in this Manhattan, this piece of the world defined for me by Congo, when he passed me the gift. Manhattan is my jail."
And in the jail, time was suspended. One morning, a new prisoner passed him a sheet from a smuggled newspaper, and Cormac began to read every line. Down at the bottom of the social notes, a name caught his eyes. It said, "Lady Warren of Carrickfergus has sailed for Charleston on the Intrepid. She was in New York visiting her son, who is serving with the Crown Forces.
From Charleston, she will return to her estate in Ireland.
Lady Warren of Carrickfergus. Bridget Riley. Visiting her son. It never ends. It never fecking ends.
The commander of the Bridewell was a major named William Cunningham. The older prisoners knew how Cunningham worked.
He pockets half the money allowed for food and sends it home by courier. He wants the war to last forever, so he can bank enough to join the gentry.
Cunningham didn't come often to see the victims of his corruption. But 8 months into his stay in the Bridewell, Cormac looked up to see Cunningham's new second-in-command. He was walking beyond the bars down a safe corridor beside Cunningham. The son of the Earl of Warren and Bridget Riley. His hair was lighter, with highlights of red, but otherwise he could have been a twin of the Earl in that year when he stepped from the black coach to look upon the broken body of Rebecca Carson lying in the mud. They called him Tony Warren. He worked under Cunningham, but in all the small ways Cunningham deferred to his noble blood. Together they helped men die. They died because William Cunningham, the provost marshal, stole half the ration money, while Tony Warren shrugged and cocked an eyebrow and chuckled. On the night of the 4th of July in 1780, the prisoners roared defiance in the Bridewell and sang the Liberty songs and cursed the king. Cunningham came himself that night, with Tony Warren behind him, their faces dark with fury. They chose the men they wanted, then called on the services of Bloodstone, the army blacksmith. He was carrying a 20-pound hammer. They laid each man flat upon the floor for all to see, and then Bloodstone smashed their knees and elbows. They screamed and screamed and screamed.
"Fecking rabble,"
Warren said as he followed Cunningham out of the row of cells. And as he whirled, his coat opened and Cormac saw that he was wearing the sword. Saw the spirals etched in steel, thinking, "My father's sword." Telling himself, "I must get out of the Bridewell. I must find Tony Warren on the streets of New York. I must return my father's sword to the blood of his blood." Whores were the agents of salvation. One of them was named Kitty Nevins, red-haired, full-breasted, with the guts, Cormac thought, of 9 burglars. She devised the code and smuggled it into the prison and then chalked the first coded messages on slate that they could read from the cell windows. She it was, with 2 of her sisters, who seduced the guards with perfumed flesh and smuggled in the guns, who had horses waiting. Suddenly, more than 20 of the prisoners were running free, mad and desperate. In the break for the street, Cormac shot 2 redcoats, one with a pistol, the second with a musket. He dropped the musket, jammed the pistol in his waistband, lunged for 1 horse-drawn carriage and fell short into mud and watched the carriage gallop toward the North River, heard shouts, curses, more gunfire, and ran north through the black rain. Then saw torches ahead, veered left, more torches. And then from the ebony darkness he heard the whinny of a horse, familiar. And he came, black as the night, there when Cormac needed him. Thunder. They galloped together into the blind watches of the night, moved like ghosts through blank spaces, heading to what was left of the Manhattan Wild. Until thunder slowed, then stopped, then shook as if telling Cormac to slide off here. Thunder galloped into the darkness. Cormac felt boneless from fatigue and could see nothing clearly through the curtains of rain. He whispered in Irish, "Wash away the filth, please." Then an arm gripped his neck and he felt the tip of a knife against his back. "Who are you?" a deep voice growled. Cormac said his true name. The arm relaxed and he was spun around, and there, soaked and grizzled, white hairs driving like tacks from the inside of black cheeks, was Quacko.
"God damn," he said, "if it ain't you for true, Mr. Cormac."
Quacko saved him. He snapped the manacles with wire cutters, and his wife, now white-haired, fed Cormac lentil soup and meat and bread. Roger, the oldest son, then opened a trap door leading by ladder to a room chopped out of stone beneath the house, a secret room with a bed, several muskets, trunks, a sacred African drum, and jugs of water. On the first night, Cormac slept for many hours. He did not come upstairs until it was dark.
You not the first Irish have been down there, Quacko said, laughing.
Quacko's four sons moved in and out, curious about this latest white man, and wary too. They lived in an area of free blacks, with Quacko carrying faked papers dating his own freedom to 1738, before the revolt. He and Cormac talked about the night when Cormac helped Quacko to escape with his wife, telling the story more for the sons than for each other. Then one night, in the second week, Quacko looked at Cormac in an inquisitive way.
You ain't aged but a day, he said. I ain't even gone to ask how come, but you was close to Congo.
Yes, very close.
Quacko didn't go beyond this, and Cormac just stared at the fire. Then they talked about the revolution and the future. Quacko had little faith in the revolution.
You notice something? The English, they promise in freedom to their slaves after everything's finished. But the Americans, they ain't promising nothing.
When the snows melted, Cormac found work as a blacksmith with a man named Tingle, whose love of metals had driven him into the madness of alchemy. His forge in a dark forest glen was empty when Cormac arrived. Cormac built a new fire in the forge and took over the blacksmithing and moved from Quacko's cellar to a heatless room above the barn. At night, Cormac was always moving, his face sometimes stained black with berry juice, visiting the scattered Africans. He made speeches in Yoruba and English, trying to persuade the Africans and their American children that their best hope for freedom lay with the revolution. At the same time, disguised as a lame peddler or a hunched old man, and even once as an Indian, Cormac tracked the movements of young Tony Warren. The son of the Earl moved from barracks to confiscated house and back to the barracks, to the reopened John Street Theater, to the whorehouses of the Holy Ground. He had the sword. Cormac wanted it back. In his pursuit of Tony Warren, Cormac moved alone. This was a private affair, after all, not the business of the revolution. Then, almost a year after his escape from the Bridewell, he picked up the trail. Warren now lived in a house on Beaver Street, a house taken from Americans and shared with three other officers, but the Englishman was never alone there. There were rumors, brought to Cormac by Roger and Quacko, and whispered by another in a grog shop, that young Warren was building a new house on his father's land, high in the Bloomingdale, that he planned to settle in New York once the rebels were destroyed. The city remained ruled by martial law, but it was more relaxed now as social life returned. Then, one rain-drowned night, Cormac started toward Broadway. Across the street, Warren stepped out of a bordello. He was alone. He took small, precise steps, like a man who had sipped too much wine. Cormac moved past